Now on News Talk, continuing our season of documentary on News Talk, producer Brian Gallagher explores the ever-changing face of Irish society in That Will Never Catch On.
I know my first hamburger was in Captain America's, and we thought we were just so cool.
I am a smoker, and I just feel that we're treated like pariahs by society today.
They are absolutely terrified the first day, so I relaxed them.
I wasn't allowed to have a Tamagotchi, but I babysat one for 24 hours and minded it for my friend because you had to give it attention every couple of hours or it would go and die.
I used to be afraid of robbers, afraid of other people. Like, you read all this negative stuff in the papers, and yet in all the time we had people to the house, not one thing was taken or broken or damaged. And I think that's incredible, really.
Unplug the kids for at least a couple of hours during the day and just bring back the, you know, just the whole world of make-believe and get the kids playing again.
Stuff like dogs in the office is a big thing. In San Francisco, I think there's more dogs than children, which gives kind of an insight into a whole heap of things. And it kind of strips away the cold, barren aspect of a very ruthless, you know, working environment.
There were these older ladies who served the meal and they'd shout out, "Gents' liver!" And there was, the guys got a bigger portion of meal than the ladies.
I do miss the old films where I understood every word that was being said. And I also miss the old cinemas, which had a magic.
You see kids of 18 months in their buggies with their mum's phone. And I have to say, that to me is the saddest and the most infuriating thing.
So if your number was Bal Harbour 4, you counted the rings. If there were 4 rings, the call was for you. So you answered. And there were 7 of us in the house, tearing around the place. If the phone rang, it was going, "Shh, shh, count the rings."
Broadly speaking, technology definitely is a force for good, and I don't think any of us could exist or live the types of lives we have now without technology.
Everything is overpackaged. You can't even get a bar of chocolate that you can open anymore. You need directions as to how to open it.
One husband came in to me and said that his wife didn't know anything, and he was terrified he'd pass away first. So what he wanted was that she'd be able to do her shopping on the internet.
Change is a strange thing. Sometimes it's sudden and obvious. Other times it creeps up on us. A tipping point is reached and a shift has taken place. So let's hear what people have to say about how Ireland continues to change, starting with a visit to the cinema. Going to the pictures was very popular in Ireland in the early 70s. Roland and Sue Spencer, who worked in the haematology department in Jervis Street Hospital, sometimes had their cinema visits cut short in unusual fashion, as Roland explains.
At that time, for covering on call at night, there was no such thing as bleeps. At least we didn't have them as there were. In the hospital, we would sometimes go to the cinema, and the Adelphi was only a few hundred yards up the road. We might drop into the switch in the hospital and let them know where we were going, and in the event that they wanted us, they would ring the cinema, and the cinema would flash up a little message on the screen saying, "Could the person on call for haematology in Jervis Street please go to the lab?" And you just get up and leave, and and that was it.
And although Jervis Street was the centre for the cutting-edge practice of organ transplants, Sue recalls the low-tech way it was administered.
It involved me every month going through my files and seeing who was actually actively waiting and writing their names and their blood groups and their tissue types and where they came from and whatever else. And then going and photocopying and sellotape all the sheets together so that it came up as one big list.
Then things changed, and the first steps were taken towards computerisation.
Well, we did a bit of fundraising and we got one of the first Apple computers. It was a 64K Superbrain. It was the mainstay for all our data collection. And we did investigate to see about if we could get a hard drive. And they wanted £5,400 for a 5 megabyte hard drive. So we just certainly couldn't rise to that. So it wasn't until 1986 that we ended up getting a proper system with proper hard drives. And that system lasted for many years after we moved to Beaumont.
Theatre producer and former chair of the Arts Council, Pat Moylan, reflects on how television viewing has changed.
When I was young in Portlaoise, we just had RTE1 and then eventually RTE2. And it was like a different world because it was, first of all, not very many people had televisions when we got our television first. So it was very exciting to bring the kids in from the neighbourhood to watch Mr. Ed or Rin Tin Tin or those kind of programmes, which were fascinating.
Pat recalls how everyone watched the same programme at the same time and how appearing on television made a person a local celebrity.
You know, as you get into adulthood and you're looking at the soaps and you're looking at the Reardons back then, and everybody discussed it in great detail about what had happened the previous night. I mean, even when I got married first, which is 40 years ago now, my husband was on a television commercial. People stopped him in the street regularly saying, "I saw you on television." People approached him in pubs and in restaurants and places like that. That would never, ever happen now. I mean, there are so many faces and we're all on television to a certain extent with YouTube, and we have our own opinions. We can write our own reviews of things, and we're all journalists and we're television makers with the technology that's out there.
While Pat enjoyed the communal element of television viewing in the past, she recognises the convenience of modern ways of viewing.
Well, I mean, it's good and bad. We have a great variety of stuff on Netflix, for example, and we can sit in on a weekend and watch back-to-back box sets, which would never have happened before. Things have changed so much in terms of the way people view television, but it has even changed over the last number of years where you had to go in and buy your box set from the record shop and bring it home. And, you know, that was a little bit of effort. Now there is no effort involved. Working.
I left school in 1976 and I started working in a local company at that stage, because in those days banks recruited men directly after the Leaving Cert, which would have been September, but they didn't recruit women until the spring to allow them actually complete their commercial course, so they were able to come in and do typing.
Miriam Rogers, former bank manager, recalls how gender determined the roles that staff were assigned.
Most of the women were secretaries. They were secretaries to the manager, the deputy manager, the assistant managers. I was general typist, and then I moved into securities. And that's really the way most women started then, was into typing roles, secretarial roles.
After a year, Miriam was moved into cash, which was considered quite prestigious.
The branch I worked in was a big branch, and you had your little own cash box with little doors on it, and nobody was allowed inside your box. Nobody touched your cash. But actually, we didn't even have calculators then. There was an old, like a contometer machine, and that's how you had to balance in the evening. And there was only one electric calculator, so there was a rush at the end of the day to get the electric calculator to do your balancing.
And if 70s banking methods seem antiquated, so too is the policy regarding female staff and marriage.
In 77, when I joined, we were only three or four years after the marriage bar. So up until 73, 74, if women got married, they had to leave within 2 years and they got a marriage gratuity.
Gender discrimination even extended to the canteen.
So the branch was a big branch, and there was a canteen upstairs, and you went up and they did the dinner, the meat and two veg. But I always remember there were these older ladies who served the meal. It was brought to the table for you. There was always the day when they did liver, and they'd shout out, "Gents, liver." And the guys got a bigger portion of the meal than the ladies.
In time, progress came about, though not without some resistance.
So the bank changed. I mean, I recall, you know, having gone from typewriters, and it must have been the early 80s, the bank tried to introduce computers. And it was a huge issue with the union to introduce computers to do the typing. And they were only allowed to bring in so many into head office. Everybody else had to stay on the old typewriters. But they brought in a few as a pilot into the recruitment area. And of course, that all changed. Subsequently, it just became widespread. Nobody would tolerate having a typewriter.
Opportunities were opening up for women, and Miriam rose through the ranks.
I got my first management position around 79-80, senior bank official, and then I got officer grade, and then subsequently assistant manager, manager. But I mean, the thing in the bank was most people in ranks up to manager were women. And then when you got to manager level, it flipped totally in that the majority were males. So it was quite an interesting dilemma they had. And they did try at times to see why was that. You know, they brought groups of women like myself in to say, OK, we had got through to manage a rank. What was stopping other women coming through? And it was all the same things, I suppose, that are there now. Children, maternity leave, change of priorities when you have family. And in general, women are the first port of call when it comes to childcare. If anything happens with your childminder or the child is sick, it's generally the woman who goes to it. So I think that's probably still prevalent today.
Telephone communication has changed enormously. Claire Garrahy remembers how calls used to be received in rural Ireland.
Our number in Belharbour was Belharbour 4. The telephone exchange, the local exchange, the lady there, Mrs. Daly, she clocked off at 6 o'clock in the evening. So after that, it was controlled by the main exchange in Ennis. So we were, from 6 o'clock on, we were on what they called a party line. So there might have been five households on the party line. So if your number was Belharbour 4, you counted the rings. If there were four rings, the call was for you. So you answered. But it was three, it was the Healy's. If it was five, it was the Cairns family. And there were seven of us in the house, tearing around the place. If the phone rang, it was going, shh, shh, count the rings.
Later, when automated messages were brought in, there could be confusion.
My father-in-law, Jack Garrahy, a great character. Jack had a phone, of course, and would buy and sell the fish from the fishermen, and they would bring the lobster and the fish in their curraghs. So he would, you know, he'd regularly have to ring in his ear. And it was fine when the operator, he would twist the handle and the operator would answer and he'd say, hello, put me through to Inishere 1, which was the post office. Anyway, they went automated, as you know. So he got the new phone book. And he was a big man, big hands. It was tricky enough for him to dial. Invariably, anyway, we'd get the number wrong. He wouldn't rotate the dial fully or whatever. And of course, he got this message. The number you have dialed is incorrect. Please check your number and dial again. To which Jack would reply, well, I'm terribly sorry about that. I didn't mean to do that now. Sorry to bother you. So he'd redial. The same thing would happen again. So Jack would say, well, actually, I did think I dialed the right number. But anyway, whatever you say yourself, thank you very much. The third time, well, let's just say that the flowery language would be introduced then. Not realising, of course, that he was speaking to an answering machine. And Frank Kelly's 12 Days of Christmas comes to mind. As it happened, things got more strongly worded, shall we say, Brian.
There was no confusion for Peter Rogers and his friends, who started out with traditional childhoods, but who embraced technology as it emerged.
I'm 28 now, so I think I got my first mobile phone when I would have been 12. It was a strange shift from, I remember, kind of, I was quite active as a kid and would be playing soccer and tennis and stuff. And you went from using a payphone to call home, to, oh, I'm okay, yeah, I'll be another hour or whatever, to now you can kind of send a text message. Definitely, I think from my social group, it's kind of impacted the way that we engage with technology because we know of a life before it. Like it used to be, you wouldn't be sending a text message to see where all your buddies were. Where did everyone drop their bikes? Whose house were they outside? Or if you wanted to go see where everyone was, are they on the green playing football or rugby or whatever the case was? Whereas now I think that's definitely kind of shifted.
Now that Peter and his friends have grown up, technology is an integral but sometimes intrusive presence in their lives.
Like my generation is one where you don't really get a break from work. So there's a certain degree of you're on call at all times. You're accessible because the expectation is that even if you have a company phone, a lot of times you'll either have that with you or you'll have maybe your work email or whatever on your personal phone.
When out socialising, Peter's friends try to take technology out of the equation.
When me and my friends make a conscious effort to get together, a lot of the times we'll either, everyone has to keep their phone in their pocket or we'll put it out on the table. And if you're going for drinks or for lunch or something like that, the first one, if someone reaches for their phone, then they pick up the check. And you kind of make fun ways for that, but to also ensure that everyone's present, which is difficult because we all have kind of different demands. And I grew up with a pretty close group of eight guys, and of that eight, got one in Singapore, two in London, I'm in California. So it's always tricky being all back together. So when we do, we kind of make a big effort.
But although mobile phones can be disruptive, they also facilitate friends gathering.
It's much easier to coordinate getting together from everyone all sides of the world. We get to stay in contact from that too. I think the big focus that I'm kind of happy with in our group is when we're together and the phones go away. But undoubtedly, it's the double-edged sword. They're also the reason we're all still in close contact and we're still a very close group of friends, even though we haven't all lived in the same country for the last 10 years. And that's by virtue of technology.
Your attention, please. Please do not smoke in the terminal building. Smoking is only permitted in the specified smoking areas. Thank you.
Since 2004, smoking has been banned in the workplace. Hugh McCusker remembers how things used to be.
Well, back in the day, it seems almost as if I worked back in medieval times. A constant blue haze. Everyone smoked, as indeed they smoked everywhere else, in hospitals and pubs and what have you.
As well as smoking habits changing, Hugh's job, regarded as a skilled craft at the time, has been overtaken by technology.
I was a compositor in the printing industry. In my case, my father had been a compositor, and so I followed suit, where you were expected to serve your time, as they put it, for 7 long years. Well, this was the days of what they call the old hot metal days. We handled type. You did a lot of typesetting. You had this implement called a stick, and cases, various cases full of different typefaces. And you would take these out with by hand, put them into the stick to make a line, which you would place on a tray, and it was tied with a piece of string. You then placed it on a small printing press where you inked it manually and then pulled this roll over to get a proof of it, which was then handed in to the proofreader to check for mistakes. The whole job at that time was labour-intensive. At the end of the day, you certainly came home tired, and yet there was a great feeling of gratification, as something that you don't get sitting at a computer all day.
But in time, computerisation did away with compositors. Then another change came along, the smoking ban. So how did you regard that?
I didn't feel particularly good about it, particularly where public houses were concerned. It was always enjoyable to sit in the pub with your pint and your cigarette. And that all changed, resulting in my going to the pub less frequently. So I think it's gone to extremes. There seems to be a lack of humanity where smokers are concerned.
Obviously, you're a smoker.
I am a smoker, yes. I'm not advocating smoking, but I am a smoker. And I just feel that we're treated like pariahs by society today.
Unlike Hugh, Sue and Roland Spencer welcomed the smoking ban. They remember working in Jervis Street Hospital when smoking was commonplace.
Everybody would come out of ward round and you'd find maybe 3 or 4 people there sitting around having a smoke, discussing, you know, what had happened on ward rounds and things like that.
In those days, everybody smoked, and certainly you would walk into the canteen in the hospital and just look across a fog of smoke from all the doctors and nurses smoking. Not like that now, of course. They're not allowed.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben? Come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean clear to Flagtown. Come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah,
CB radio made a sudden impact in the late 70s. But there's a difference between real change and the fad. And CB radio's brief flourishing was the epitome of a fad. We asked people to recall other crises that lingered in their memories.
Well, I do, of course, remember the hula hoops, and they were a fad, but they were great fun, and we spent hours on the hula hoop. Plus, they were also great for your body, great for keeping the waistline down. And it's funny to see it in some cases it's coming back again.
When I was younger, pogs were very popular. They were little round discs that you stacked up in a pile like a pillar, and then you had to use what was called a slammer, which was a plastic, heavier version. And the more pogs that you could flip the other way around, you got to keep. So you'd collect your own. There were shinies and regular pogs and then slammers. But I remember my granny was living in America at the time, and she used to send us pogs that nobody else could get. So you were in great competition then, because people wanted to win your pogs.
The thing I remember most was those radios that you could pick up the airplanes on. So we used to go up to the back of the airport and sit there on a Sunday afternoon with this radio up in the air with a huge aerial and listen to the planes coming in.
French skipping. You just got a packet of elastic bands and you tied them together. There was 2 people each side, and we used to jump in the middle and we'd go in the yard and we'd French skip.
Definitely the fact when I was in secondary school age would have been the football cards, and we were all collecting the different players for the FA Cup leagues and all of those things. They were the big fad.
Actually, spinning tops were a big thing when I was in school. And of course, the trick was to see how long you could get yours to spin. It was a spool and you just whisked the top of it and just hoped that it'd keep going the longest.
We used to play a game of Sabutio, which was very much football related. It was a green, almost like mat carpet that you'd put down on the floor, and then you'd have like little individual players and little ball, and then you'd just flick the player at the ball and then ball moved on, and that's how you'd play the game. Looking back now, it was probably quite primitive.
The other thing I remember was Tamagotchis, which were little keyring size electronic pets, essentially. And you had to babysit the Tamagotchi and feed it and water it, and it would hatch from an egg and it grew into a creature. And I remember I wasn't allowed to have a Tamagotchi, but I babysat one for 24 hours and minded it for my friend, because you had to give it attention every couple of hours or it would go and die.
Clackers were things that it was like, for all the world, like a lollipop stick with two little strings, and at the end of each of the strings were plastic balls. And basically, if you moved the stick up and down, the balls jumped up and hit each other over the stick, and if you did it really quickly, it made a kind of a clacking sound. And almost every girl in my class, it was the sound of this clacking all over the playground that Christmas. I remember when we went back to school, it was just unbelievable that a fad could take on, and as quickly as they came, they went.
You're listening to That Will Never Catch on Documentary on News Talk.
Ireland went from being a country with very little foreign cuisine to having a pizza parlour or Chinese takeaway in almost every town and village. It brought about a big change in eating habits, and we asked people to recall their memories of trying out this new food.
My first memory of foreign food, I think, was someone brought me to an Indian restaurant, and admittedly I was wary because we had been so restricted before that. And I found to my delight that I loved it. And of course, since then, I've discovered Italian and Chinese and Thai food.
So what was that first Indian dish?
Oh, chicken masala. It was very hot, I seem to recall, anyway. I had to ask him to cool it down for me.
I know my first hamburger was in Captain America's, and we thought we were just so cool.
It was the first time I had a real Chinese curry. The taste was amazing. It was just boiled rice and curry, but it was the nicest meal ever. And it's remarkable to be able to almost taste and smell the after all this time.
I remember the first pizza, and I thought it was very doughy. And I thought to myself, I wonder why did they not just have cheese on toast?
The first Chinese restaurant in the town opened. We thought this was fantastic, and we tried duck and plum sauce, and lemon chicken was another one. Some of them we liked and some of them we found a bit sickly sweet. It wasn't high-end Chinese cuisine.
The first pizza place that I can remember was in Drumcondra.
We went down and we grabbed a pizza.
More of that, they said.
Yeah. Well, it was just so novel. We didn't think of calories and fat or anything like that in those days. We didn't have to worry about when we were younger.
My first Indian, I'll never forget it, tandoori chicken. And it just didn't agree with me. It was too much of a shock to the system. I've never had Indian since.
We sat down and this green pear-shaped thing, and I had no idea. I had to watch them how they ate it, and there was an avocado.
My first big foreign dinner was going into the Sunflower restaurant in O'Connell Street. A friend of mine was in Dublin about 3 months before me, so she knew the place backwards. She suggested I order sweet and sour chicken. Well, I can't tell you how awful I thought it was. I mean, the idea of putting sweet things like pineapple with chicken just destroyed meat. How could anybody ever eat that? And rice on top of it, which was, you know, something you had for a pudding and not for your main course.
If food has changed in Ireland, technology has changed even more. There are people who embrace this, and someone had to be the first kid on the block with a digital watch, as Cliff Brown acknowledges.
I was that kid. Yes, I think I always had a love for technology and gadgetry, which I probably inherited from my father, who was a man who was into hi-fi and wires here and there and aerials and all that. And he had a great sound setup, and he had this reel-to-reel tape recorder. He was into all that. So I think I inherited a love for these cutting-edge devices from him. And I don't think that there's any badness in that. I think it's good that people would be up to date with technology if they're interested in it and know what's good and how it can help.
Hugh McCusker, however, doesn't share Cliff's love of gadgets.
Technology, like computers, are a wonderful invention. The mobile phone is a wonderful invention. Unfortunately, there's a pandemic addiction to mobile phones. People are bringing it into theatres and cinemas, much to the annoyance of other people. Everything today has gone to excess, I think. The ideas are good, but they have been abused.
It's probably safe to say that Hugh would balk at Cliff's latest gadget.
The Fitbit is worn throughout the day and measures a number of parameters. It would look at your heart rate, and it'll also look at if you've climbed stairs, swimming in some instances if it's waterproof, cycling, use of gym equipment like treadmills. So it will give a good indicator of what sort of physical activity you've undertaken throughout your day. It then measures your sleep as well, and it can tell things like the amount of REM sleep you have, the amount of times you were awake during the night, also what sort of deep sleep you had, how long you were in the deep sleep. And this is a good indicator of overall health in many respects.
But Hugh feels we're already swamped with information.
We have news on the television 24/7. Again, in excess. There's too much news, and it's mostly depressing. There's no happy medium. It's everything is extreme today.
So a final word from both viewpoints.
Broadly speaking, technology definitely is a force for good, and I don't think any of us could exist or live the types of lives we have now without technology.
I miss what were termed the innocent times, and there was a greater sense of community when I was growing up, which sadly seems to have gone into decline. But having said that, there has to be some progress. But unfortunately, progress doesn't always bring advantage.
In the past, holidays for Irish people were largely spent in Ireland. Then fun fairs and seaside resorts were left behind when package holidays to the sun became affordable for many people. But after the economic crash, holidays in Ireland became popular again and have stayed so, as Claire Garrahy of Doolan Tuaran Ferries explains.
Well, I think this was one of the very few upsides of the crash, you know, the staycationers. I mean, I would have experienced a lot of families coming to the west of Ireland and experiencing the Wild Atlantic Way. Very often three generations, grandparents, parents, children. And I have to say it was lovely to see them coming back and bringing their children from Dublin, Cork, Limerick, wherever, to experience the west of Ireland, and lovely to see them coming in with their wellies and their raincoats and just getting out there and doing what we all did as children.
So what does Claire say to people regarding the Irish weather?
Cover every eventuality, because we do get the four seasons in one day, sometimes in 1 hour in the west of Ireland. And I know when my children were small, we spent a lot of time in the Aran Islands. We left the house every morning with the picnic, the rain jackets, the swimsuits, the towels, the sunglasses, the sun cream, you name it. We were prepared and we had some fabulous holidays. So much to be explored. I mean, just to equip the kids with little fishing nets, let them run along the rocks and do some rock pool fishing. And they love it, like the kids love it. They thrive on it. And the other thing is, of course, they sleep at night. They sleep well after a day out in the Wild Atlantic Way, out in the fresh air.
If staycations represent a change in the holiday market, the other big development is Airbnb. Evelyn Pender shares her first-hand experience.
How we were introduced to Airbnb, I suppose somebody recommended it to us and said that it was a great way to travel around the world. So we did that and we really, really enjoyed it. So we're empty nesters, and my husband and myself, we said we'd get into it. And basically it was that someone would have an ensuite room. They would come for a minimum of 2 nights, that we would be able to tell them all about Dublin. And with Airbnb, I think it's much easier to see what it's like to live as a person who's from Dublin and what our lives and family life is like. You get to talk with people about that. I think that's the big change, and people really enjoy it.
So what's it like to rent out a portion of your house to a series of strangers?
It depends really on how private a person you are. Obviously, if you hate people in your house, you shouldn't do it. But if you enjoy company and you enjoy people with different lifestyles from you, or people who have different experiences. Now, we'd be a more mature couple, and we tended to get a more mature visitor.
There was one unexpected bonus to Evelyn's new role.
I used to be afraid of robbers, afraid of other people. Like, you read all this negative stuff in the papers, and yet in all the time we had people to the house, not one thing was taken or broken or damaged. And I think that's incredible, really. It's like before in Ireland, we lock up your house, lock up your children, lock up everything. And it was a sort of a scare culture. And I think Airbnb is a kind of a more open society where you're more willing to share. I think that's different. It has given me back a high level of trust for other people.
A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Pat Moylan reflects on how life as a theatre producer has changed.
I mean, email has changed the face of working life. It's very efficient. It means you don't have to pick up the phone. I remember as a producer, I'd be on the phone all day long. Now I work from home. I'm not on the phone, I'm on the computer, and I can tell people exactly what they need to know very efficiently, and that's the end of it.
Communicating with customers has also changed.
Remember when I was marketing shows, I ran a small theatre called Andrews Lane, and we'd have to put together a mailing list, and we'd be sending out letters into envelopes and physically putting stamps on them to send them out, thousands of them, before a show started. Now you can just press a button on the computer, write one letter, and you know, you can have them sent to as many as possible free of charge, which is, you know, just incredible.
Publicity too works differently from in the past.
The fact that we have so many radio and television stations now in comparison to then, I remember if Gay Byrne said your show was good, then you'd sell out for the run. I mean, there isn't a Gay Byrne anymore. There are so many radio stations. There's nobody that takes that place, that has that power. You know, I suppose it's good in some ways, but it was really very good if Gay came in to the opening night and liked the show and spoke about it on his radio show the following morning.
And it's not just theatre that's changed. The visual arts have also moved with the times, as painter Vincent Smith explains.
A piece of equipment that is essential to any artist is a really good digital camera. You can bring it back, you can upload the views that you've taken onto your laptop, and to use particular packages to enhance the view or increase the light, reduce the light, increase the contrast, and they help you to produce a composition that is fixed and translates into a really effective painting.
So what other new appliances are visual artists using?
Things like mobile devices like iPads, where you can overlay grid lines on landscapes. So when you're out in the open, you can use these tools to capture the scene.
When it comes to exhibiting, artists traditionally relied on galleries.
The primary mechanism was exhibitions and word of mouth. I mean, you would read in, you know, the weekend newspapers reviews of exhibitions opened the previous week, but that would only apply to pretty established artists. But for young artists and that, I can't imagine how difficult it must have been to get the word out there. So things have changed so much in the intervening years.
Artists today, while still using galleries, also have their own websites. Vincent even publishes a newsletter. I asked him who his target audience was.
A cohort of friends and family and acquaintances, you can reach out to them once or twice in the year with a newsletter. Short, sharp, to the point, summarises exhibition details that are coming up, gives your audience a sample of recent works that you may have done. You know, without technology, that really wouldn't be a runner.
Sue Spencer is an active member of Castleknock Tennis Club, and tennis is a sport that's changed a lot. No longer just the summer game, players today can play all the year round thanks to floodlighting and indoor courts. Sue, though, remembers how things used to be.
I went to a boarding school, and when you were about to start, you were sent a list of all the things that you had to have in your trunk, like so many pairs of stockings that had to be mandarin, I think was the colour, the horrible, gross, browny thing. We all had these dark brown legs and pale skin. But top of the list for the sport was a tennis racket, and you had to go into Elvery's and buy this racket, and it came in a wooden press. And you went off and you bought your trunk, and we had to get your white plimsolls and all of that. And we had four grass courts. But I have to put my hand up and say, the whole time I was there, I never played tennis. I came to tennis late in life. I came to tennis in my mid-40s. And once again, we went into Elvery's and bought two rackets to see if we'd be able to hit a ball.
So how have rackets changed since Sue's boarding school days?
Now they're incredibly light. I presume there's some carbon composite. And even at my age now, I can still whack a ball.
although the balls too have changed.
Gone are the old white balls and now you have these lovely luminous yellow ones. I suppose as you get older it makes them easier to see. I would play maybe about 4 times a week now.
Which is some change from never taking her old wooden racket out of its press. Another sport that's changed is sailing. I asked Cliff Brown how sailors managed before technology made things easier.
Well, it was visual mainly. You just had to have lookout and you were limited by what you could see. Also, people had sound signals in fog using a foghorn. Sound actually travels better in fog. It's a denser air. And so the sound of a foghorn can be picked up in quite a distance away. So visual and auditory information was all there was. There was nothing else really.
So do sailors still use foghorns?
Yes, we do. It would be unusual though. It would be if you saw a vessel on its way towards you, you would use the foghorn as a sound signal to warn them that you are in the vicinity and they would then take it whatever evasive action is required.
Modern equipment has made sailing safer. So what are the main benefits?
Use of these new technologies to make sure that your boat is in proper deep water, that you are aware of your surroundings when visibility might be limited. So even when we can't see, and that would be regularly enough with fog, and sea fog can be an issue, we can always rely on our instrumentation to ensure we know exactly what's going on around us and where we are. Every time I see your face, it reminds me of the places we used to go.
But all I've got is a photograph and I realize... Photographs have changed enormously. From black and white snaps that people used to stick in albums, to colour slides that they projected onto screens at home, to high quality colour prints that were collected from the chemist's shop. Now photographs are digital, and with every mobile phone doubling as a camera, there's never been so much visual recording. Skype, too, has radically changed how people stay in touch from the far side of the world. Dubliner Peter Rogers, who lives in San Francisco, explains how he maintains contact.
So Skype obviously is the thing that everyone knows. You use Skype usually if you're contacting family, relatives, that kind of thing. But I find for my generation, we'd use FaceTime as well. I get calls from buddies on nights out and stuff like that. You use WhatsApp, a lot of voice calling from there and text messages. So I'd stay in contact with people. I've been living away for a few years and I'd still have the ability to talk to a lot of my friends maybe a couple of times a week. But it means that the relationships that you have before you leave don't disappear. Like, you stay friends with the people that you were friends with before. I have multiple forms of social media that I get updates on. You see it with current affairs. I still know quite a lot about what's going on, whereas in the past I'd maybe have to try to track down somewhere that was selling a couple of day old newspapers.
But while Peter likes to stay in touch with life in Ireland, he appreciates the fact that California can be to the fore in bringing about change.
So what's interesting about it is California obviously is the hub of a lot of technology. I think Dublin is fortunate, but also Ireland in general, to have a lot of technology investment. But with that comes the culture of those companies. So I worked in a big software company in Dublin, and what I found was the policies there were pretty much identical because they're trying to create the same kind of culture. So you see stuff like, you know, you can bring your dog into the office, or they give you an allowance for the gym, or you get free food, or all these little things that when I worked in Irish companies, it kind of scoffed at a little bit. You know, it's you're there to work. And it's interesting, it's kind of a double-edged sword too, because I always use free food as an example. Your lunch is catered, that's great, you know, it's free, extra money in your pocket. But the cynical side of me says, yeah, it's a great way to get people to not go out, walk around, wait to get their lunch, come back in. So instead of taking an hour for your lunch, you sit down, you eat your food in 15 minutes and you're back at your desk, or you take your food to your desk.
As a dog lover, Peter would like to see more Irish companies adopting the Californian approach to pets in the workplace.
There's more dogs than children in San Francisco, which gives kind of an insight into a whole heap of things. But by virtue of that, you see a lot of dogs in the workplace, in the office. And it's a nice little break. Normally, maybe you go for a walk in the morning, or you take a cup of coffee or whatever. If one of your buddies in the office has a dog, you take the dog for a walk, or you take it across the park across the way and throw a ball for it for 5 minutes on your lunch break or whatever the case may be. But it's definitely a pattern break and can be a little bit distracting if you're getting them settled down. But what I've seen is the dogs very quickly understand when to engage stage and when not to. You see people smiling and laughing and joking a lot more. And it kind of strips away the cold, barren aspect of a very ruthless working environment. Suddenly you've got a dog running around the place and everyone's laughing at that. And that definitely changes the tone or the environment a little bit.
Mary Rooney is a volunteer who teaches computer skills.
Older people usually come in to me and they are absolutely terrified the first day. They're very confident people, but they lose it when it comes to technology. So I relax them and they say, look, they have tried on their laptop or their iPad to do emails, and then their grandchildren or their children come in and say, I'll do it for you. And they're very impatient, so they feel very foolish. So we start off with, what do you like? So I first of all introduced them to YouTube, and there's loads of videos on YouTube on gardening or on films or whatever they like. And we might then, the next session, we would do an email to their families.
So does mastering a few basics make a big difference?
Absolutely. One person said it was absolutely magical. There's another person wants to know how to knit, and they learned to knit. One other friend of mine says that her granddaughter, who lived in Australia, she taught her to knit over Skype. Technology really opens up for them, especially for people who can't leave their house. One husband came in to me and said that his wife didn't know anything, and he was terrified he'd pass away first. So what he wanted was that she'd be able to do her shopping on the internet. So I did that for her, and then she was able to Skype her grandchildren. Because I'm older myself, they know I'm not going to rush them. These people would be retired professionals, but they just couldn't handle the computer. One person said to me, he was the CEO of a company and his PA did all the work for him. And the big joke was, the IT person came into his office and said, did you notice anything different from your office? He said, no, we removed your laptop. He'd never used it. He couldn't even use his printer until I showed him how to use it, because technology is moving so fast.
But has that made life better or worse, or a combination of both? I asked some of our contributors what they thought were the best and worst developments. Let's hear the negatives first.
Everything is overpackaged. You can't even get a bar of chocolate that you can open anymore. You need directions as to how to open it. The other thing is, all these things are much smaller than they used to be. They're all little skithery things now.
So many people writing rules and regulations for the most simple things and making things that should be straightforward into complex issues. It is the one thing that just drives me round the twist.
The drug culture, it has ruined many young lives. That has really been a blight on our society.
You know, life balance, I suppose, work-life balance, we used to call it. It's trying to manage the pressures in work.
I think it's really sad now when teenagers especially, they don't really relate to each other anymore. And a lot of communication is body language. And if they only ever meet each other through mobile phones and they don't learn those skills, well, how are they ever going to pick them up as they mature through their lives or pass them on to the next generation?
The mobile phone, despite its convenience, was seen by many contributors as a problem.
People are using it so often and they don't seem to think that it's rude to interrupt conversations by using their mobile phone, using them in restaurants over dinner. And also, the thing that really irritates me probably more than anything else is the fact that they are on their mobile phones constantly on the street, crossing the road, not looking around.
We are becoming a nation of plugged-in children, and I do worry about that.
Movies, as they're termed today, have gone down. There's too much CGI, these computer-generated images used. Frequently, the dialogue is incoherent, and they become far too graphic, far too violent. So I do miss the old films in that respect, where I understood every word that was being said.
But it's not all bad.
Well, there are a number of good things. I mean, for instance, I think the dishwasher is a wonderful invention. I think being able to record television shows is absolutely marvellous. There are a lot of good things about today.
And other people welcomed other changes.
Well, I suppose the internet, there has to be advantages, and there's no doubt about it. It opens up the entire world from your sitting room, so that there has to be benefits of that.
I actually think Ryanair just revolutionised air travel and has made places of Europe so accessible, and I think it's wonderful.
This is the best time to be alive from a music, television, movie perspective, because this is the golden age of television. I think that stems from the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime having their own budgets and people being able to create without having to be answerable to what would have been traditional kind of executives or companies.
From a woman's perspective, I suppose it's the ability for women now to get into careers, embrace those careers, and are earning. I know there are still anomalies, but in general, I think in most companies you can earn as much as males and progress as much as you want.
In our era, I think Ireland has become a much more open society, and it's great to see tolerance, respect for diversity, which didn't exist when I was in my 20s and 30s. We are a much broader society of different races of people in the country, and we have welcomed them and they have added to our nation. And I think that's really what I would see as the greatest benefit to the country.
So in conclusion, what would people like to see in the Ireland of the future?
For Ireland of the future, I think it's dealing with these housing issues that we have, the cost of housing, bringing in more reasonably priced houses, and probably need to move some of the bigger companies outside of Dublin to try and spread it.
Unplug the kids for at least a couple of hours during the day and just bring back the whole world of make-believe and get the kids playing again.
I'd love to see the removal of the church from primary education. If we saw stuff like mindfulness classes replacing religion, where religion previously was a forced subject, maybe have it as an elective, or as you see in the States, have stuff like Sunday school.
I'd like to see a more unified society. We still have traces of polarized opinion here. For some people, life is very black and white and they don't tolerate the grey areas. I'd like to see that change.
That Will Never Catch On was produced and edited by Brian Gallagher. Our thanks to all those who took part in the project. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.